The reply came as a relief to Nomori when he woke and checked his email. It was a disappointment that he didn't wake up with company, but to expect that would have been unrealistic. Ming would have been ill-advised to spend the night anywhere but in her own bed. Nomori couldn't even drive her back. She just left, carrying her presents, well, wearing some of them, for the walk back to her own shared flat, where, Nomori fervently hoped, she wouldn't discuss her evening's adventures with her roommates. You never knew about women and how they talked. It wasn't all that dissimilar with some men, Nomori remembered from college, where some of his chums had talked at length about their conquests, as though they'd slain a dragon with a popsicle stick. Nomori had never indulged in this aural spectator sport. Either he'd had a spy's mentality even then, or he'd been somehow imbued with the dictum that a gentleman didn't kiss and tell. But did women? That was a mystery to him. Like why it was that women seemed to go to the bathroom in pairs. He'd occasionally joked that that was when they'd held their union meetings. Anyway, women talked more than men did. He was sure of that. And while they kept many secrets from men, how many did they keep from other women? Jesus, all that had to happen was for her to tell a roomie that she'd had her brains fucked out by a Japanese salaryman. And if that roomie was an informant to the MSS, Ming would get a visit from a security officer, who, at the very least, would counsel her never to see Nomori again. More likely, the counseling would involve a demand to send that degenerate American bourgeois trash, the Victoria's Secret underthings, back to him, plus a threat to lose her ministry job if she ever appeared on the same street with him again. And that also meant that he'd be tailed and observed and investigated by the MSS, and that was something he had to take seriously. They didn't have to catch him committing espionage. This was a communist country, where due process of law was a bourgeois concept unworthy of serious consideration, and civil rights were limited to doing what one was told. As a foreigner doing business in the PRC, he might get some easiness of treatment, but not all that much. So he hadn't just gotten his rocks off, Nomori told himself, past the delightful memories of a passionate evening. He'd crossed a wide red line in the street, and his safety depended entirely upon how discreet Ming was. He hadn't, could not have, warned her to keep her mouth shut about their time together. Such things weren't said, because they added a level of gravity to what was supposed to have been a time of joy and friendship, or even something potentially bigger than friendship. Women thought in such terms, Chester reminded himself, and for that reason he might see a pointed nose and whiskers the next time he looked in the mirror. But this was business, not personal, he told himself as he shut down his computer. Except for one small thing. He'd had sexual relations with an intelligent and not entirely unattractive young female human being. And the problem was that when you gave a little bit of your heart away, you never really got it back. And his heart, Nomori belatedly realized, was distantly connected to his dick. He wasn't James Bond. He could not embrace a woman as a paid whore embraced a man. It just wasn't in him to be that sort of heartless swine. The good news was that for this reason, he could stand to look in a mirror for the time being. The bad news was that this ability might be short-lived, if he treated Ming as a thing and not a person. Nomori needed advice on how to feel about this operation, and he didn't have a place to get it. It wasn't the sort of thing to email to Mary Pat or to one of the shrinks the agency employed for counseling DO people who needed a little guidance with their work. This sort of thing had to be handled face-to-face with a real person, whose body language you could read, and whose tone of voice would deliver its own content. No, email wasn't the medium he needed right now. He needed to fly to Tokyo and meet a senior officer of the Directorate of Operations who could counsel him on how to handle things. But if the guy told him to cut himself off from intimate contact with Ming, then what would he do? Nomori asked himself. It wasn't as though he had a girlfriend of any kind, and he had his needs for intimacy, too. And besides, if he cut her off, what effect would that have on his potential prospective agent? You didn't check your humanity by the door when you joined up with the agency, despite what all the books said and the public expectations were. All the chuckles over beer during the nights after training sessions seemed a distant thing now, and all the expectations he and his colleagues had had back then. They'd been so far off the mark, in spite of what their training officers had told them. He'd been a child then, and, to some extent, even in Japan. But suddenly he was a man, alone in a country that was at best suspicious, and at worst hostile to him and his country. Well, it was in her hands now, and that was something he couldn't change. Her co-workers noted a slight difference in their colleague. She smiled a little more, and in a somewhat different way. Something good must have happened to her, some of them thought, and for this they rejoiced, albeit in a reserved and private way. If Ming wished to share the experience with them, all well and good. And if not, that too was okay with them, because some things were private, even among a group of women who shared virtually everything, including stories of their minister and his fumbling, lengthy, and occasionally futile efforts at love-making. He was a wise man, and usually a gentle one, though as a boss he had his bad points. But Ming would notice none of those today. Her smile was sweeter than ever, and her eyes twinkled like little diamonds, the rest of the admin secretarial staff all thought. They'd all seen it before, though not with Ming, whose love life had been an abbreviated one, and whom the minister liked a little too much, but whom he serviced imperfectly and too seldom. She sat at her computer to do her correspondence and translations of Western news articles that might be of interest to the minister. Ming had the best English skills of anyone in this corner of the building, and the new computer system worked superbly. The next step, so the story went, was a computer into which you'd just speak, making the characters appear by voice command, sure to become the curse of every executive secretary in the world, because it would largely make them obsolete. Or maybe not. The boss couldn't fuck a computer, could he? Not that Minister Fang was all that intrusive in his demands, and the perks he delivered in return weren't bad at all. Her first morning assignment took the customary 90 minutes, after which she printed up the resulting copy and stapled the pages together by article. This morning she'd translated pieces by the Times of London and the New York Times, plus the Washington Post, so that her minister would know what the barbarians around the world thought of the enlightened policy of the People's Republic. In his private office, Minister Fang was going over other things. The MSS had a double report on the Russians. Both oil and gold, the report said. So, he thought, Zhang had been right all along. Even more right than he knew. Eastern Siberia was indeed a treasure house, full of things everyone needed. Oil, because petroleum was the very blood of modern society. And gold, because in addition to its negotiable value as an old but still very real medium of exchange, it still had industrial and scientific uses as well. And each had a cache of its own. What a pity that such riches should fall to a people without the wit to make proper use of them. It was so strange, the Russians who had given the world the gift of Marxism, but then failed to exploit it properly, and then abandoned it, only to fail also in their transition to a bourgeois capitalist society. Fang lit a cigarette, his fifth of the day. He was trying to cut back as his 70th birthday approached, and set the MSS report down on his desk before leaning back in his chair to puff on his unfiltered smoke and consider the information this morning had brought. Siberia, as Zhang had been saying for some years now, had so much that the PRC needed. Timber, minerals in abundance. Even greater abundance, so these intelligence documents said. And space, which China needed above all things. There were simply too many people in China, and that despite population control measures that could only be called draconian both in their content and in their ruthless application. Those measures were an affront to Chinese culture, which had always viewed children as a blessing. And now the social engineering was having an unexpected result. Allowed only one child per married couple, the people often chose to have boys instead of girls. It was not unknown for a peasant to take a female toddler of 2 years and drop her down a well. The merciful ones broke their necks first, to dispose of the embarrassing encumbrance. Feng understood the reasons for this. A girl child grew up to marry, to join her life to a man, while a boy child could always be depended upon to support and honor his parents, and provide security. But a girl child would merely spread her legs for some other couple's boy child. And where was the security for her parents in that? It had been true in Feng's case. As he'd grown to a senior party official, he'd made sure that his own mother and father had found a comfortable place to live out their lives, for such were the duties of a child for those who had given him life. Along the way, he'd married, of course. His wife was long dead of cardiovascular disease, and he'd given some lip service to his wife's parents, but not as much as he'd done for his own. Even his wife had understood that, and used her shadow influence as the wife of a party official to make her own special but lesser arrangements. Her brother had died young, at the hands of the American Army in Korea, and was therefore just a memory without practical value. But the problem for China that no one really talked about, even at Politburo level, was that their population policy was affecting the demographics of their country. In elevating the value of boy children over girls, the PRC was causing an imbalance that was becoming statistically significant. In 15 years or so, there would be a shortage of women. Some said that this was a good thing, because they would achieve the overarching national objective of population stability faster, but it also meant that for a generation, millions of Chinese men would have no women to marry and mate with. Would this turn into a flood of homosexuality? PRC policy still frowned upon that as a bourgeois degeneracy, though sodomy had been decriminalized in 1998. But if there were no women to be had, what was a man to do? And in addition to killing off surplus girl babies, those abandoned by their parents were often given away to American and European couples unable to have children of their own. This happened by the hundreds of thousands, with the children disposed of as readily and casually as Americans sold puppies in shopping malls. Something in Feng's soul bridled at that. But his feelings were mere bourgeois sentimentality, weren't they? National policy dictated what must be, and policy was the means to achieving the necessary goal. His was a life as comfortable as privilege could make it. In addition to a plush office, as pleasant as any capitalist's, he had an official car and driver to take him to his residence, an ornate apartment with servants to look after his needs, the best food that his country could provide, good beverages, a television connected to a satellite service so that he could receive all manner of entertainment, even including Japanese pornographic channels. For his manly drives had not yet deserted him. He didn't speak Japanese, but you didn't need to understand the dialogue in such movies, did you? Feng still worked long hours, rising at 6:30, and was at his desk before 8 every morning. His staff of secretaries and assistants took proper care of him. and some of the female ones were agreeably compliant, once, occasionally twice per week. Few men of his years had his vigor, Fang was sure, and, unlike Chairman Mao, he didn't abuse children, which he'd known of at the time and found somewhat distasteful. But great men had their flaws, and you overlooked them because of the greatness that made them who they were. As for himself and people like him, they were entitled to the proper environments in which to rest, good nourishment to sustain their bodies through their long and grueling work days, and the opportunities for relaxation and recreation that men of vigor and intelligence needed. It was necessary that they live better than most citizens of their country, and it was also earned. Giving direction to the world's most populous country was no easy task. It demanded their every intellectual energy, and such energy needed to be conserved and restored. Fang looked up as Ming entered with her folder of news articles.
"Good morning, Minister," she said with proper deference.
"Good morning, child."
Fang nodded with affection.
This one shared his bed fairly well, and for that reason merited more than a grunt. Well, he'd gotten her a very comfortable office chair, hadn't he? She withdrew, bowing proper respect for her father figure, as she always did. Fang noticed nothing particularly different about her demeanor, as he lifted the folder and took out the news articles, along with a pencil for making notations. He'd compare these with MSS estimates of the mood of other countries and their governments. It was Fang's way of letting the Ministry of State Security know that the Politburo members still had minds of their own with which to think. The MSS had signally failed to predict America's diplomatic recognition of Taiwan. Though in fairness, the American news media didn't seem to predict the actions of this President Ryan all that well either. What an odd man he was, and certainly no friend of the People's Republic. A peasant, the MSS analysts called him, and in many ways that seemed both accurate and appropriate. He was strangely unsophisticated in his outlook, something the New York Times commented upon rather frequently. Why did they dislike him? Was he not capitalist enough, or was he too capitalist? Understanding the American news media was beyond Fang's powers of analysis, but he could at least digest the things they said, and that was something the intelligence experts at the MSS Institute for American Studies were not always able to do. With that thought, Fang lit another cigarette and settled back in his chair. It was a miracle, Provalov thought. Central Army records had gotten the files, fingerprints, and photographs of the two bodies recovered in St. Petersburg, but perversely sent the records to him rather than to Abramov and Ustinov, doubtless because he was the one who had invoked the name of Sergei Golovko. Dzerzhinsky Square still inspired people to do their jobs in a timely fashion. The names and vital statistics would be faxed at once to St. Petersburg, so that his northern colleagues might see what information could be developed. The names and photographs were only a start. Documents nearly 20 years old, showing youthful, emotionless faces. The service records were fairly impressive, though. Once upon a time, Pyotr Alexeyevich Amalric and Pavel Borisovich Zimyanin had been considered superior soldiers, smart, fit, and highly reliable, politically speaking, which was why they'd gone to Spetsnaz school and sergeant school. Both had fought in Afghanistan, and done fairly well. They'd survived Afghanistan, which was not the usual thing for Spetsnaz troops, who'd drawn all of the dirtiest duty in an especially dirty war. They'd not re-enlisted, which was not unusual. Hardly anyone in the Soviet army had ever re-enlisted voluntarily. Then they'd returned to civilian life, both working in the same factory outside Leningrad, as it had been called then. But Amalric and Zimyanin had both found ordinary civilian life boring, and both, he gathered, had drifted into something else. He'd have to let the investigators in St. Petersburg find out more. He pulled a routing slip from his drawer and rubber-banded it to the records package. It would be couriered to St. Petersburg, where Abramov and Ustinov would play with the contents. "A Mr. Sherman, Mr. Secretary," Winston's secretary told him over the intercom. "Line 3.
"Hey, Sam," Sectrez said as he picked up the phone. "What's new?"
"Our oil field up north," the president of Atlantic Richfield replied.
"Good news?"
"You might say that. Our field people say that the find is about 50% bigger than our initial estimates."
"How solid is that information?"
"About as reliable as one of your T-bills, George. My head field guy is Ernie Beach. He's as good at finding oil as you used to be playing up on the street."
"Maybe even better," Sam Sherman didn't add.
Winston was known to have something of an ego on the subject of his own worth. The addendum got through anyway.
"So, summarize that for me," the Secretary of the Treasury commanded.
"So, when this field comes online, the Russians will be in a position to purchase Saudi Arabia outright, plus Kuwait and maybe half of Iran. It makes East Texas look like a fart in a tornado. It's huge, George."
"Hard to get out?"
"It won't be easy, and it won't be inexpensive. But from an engineering point of view, it's pretty straightforward. If you want to buy a hot stock, pick a Russian company that makes cold weather gear. They're going to be real busy for the next 10 years or so," Sherman advised.
"Okay, and what can you tell me of the implications for Russia in economic terms?"
"Hard to say. It will take 8 to 12 years to bring this field fully online, and the amount of crude this will dump on the market will distort market conditions quite a bit. We haven't modeled all that out, but it's going to be huge, like in the neighborhood of $100 billion per year, current year dollars, that is."
"For how long?"
Winston could almost hear the shrug that followed.
20 years, maybe more. Our friends in Moscow still want us to sit on this, but word's perking out in our company, like trying to hide a sunrise, you know. I give it a month before it breaks out into the news media. Maybe a little longer than that, but not much."
"What about the gold strike?"
"Hell, George, they're not telling me anything about that. But my guy in Moscow says the cat's gobbled down some kind of canary, or that's how it appears to him. That will probably depress the world price of gold about 5, maybe 10%. But our models say it'll rebound before Ivan starts selling the stuff he pulls out of the ground. Our Russian friends, well, their rich uncle just bit the big one and left them the whole estate, you know."
"And no adverse effects on us?" Winston thought.
"Hell no. They'll have to buy all sorts of hardware from our people, and they'll need a lot of expertise that only we have. And after that's over, the world price of oil goes down. And that won't hurt us either. You know, George, I like the Russians. They've been unlucky sons of bitches for a long time, but maybe this'll change that for 'em."
"No objections here or next door, Sam," Trader assured his friend. "Thanks for the information."
"Well, you guys still collect my taxes."
"You bastards," he didn't add. But Winston heard it anyway, including the chuckle.
"See you around, George."
"Right. Have a good one, Sam, and thanks."
Winston killed one button on his phone, selected another line, and hit his number 9 speed dial line.
"Yeah?" a familiar voice responded.
Only 10 people had access to this number.
"Jack, it's George. Just had a call from Sam Sherman, Atlantic Richfield."
"Russia?"
"Yeah. The field is 50% bigger than they initially thought. That makes it pretty damn big. Biggest oil strike ever, as a matter of fact. Bigger than the whole Persian Gulf combined. Getting the oil out will be a little expensive, but Sam says it's all cookbook stuff. Hard, but they know how it's done. No new technology to invent. Just a matter of spending the money. And not even all that much, 'cause labor is a lot cheaper there than it is here. The Russians are going to get rich."
"How rich?" the president asked.
On the order of $100 billion per year once the field is fully online, and that's good for 20 years, maybe more.
Jack had to whistle at that.
$2 trillion. That's real money, George.
That's what we call it on the street, Mr. President, Winston agreed. Sure as hell, that's real money.
And what effect will it have on the Russian economy?
It won't hurt them very much, Sektrez assured him. It gets them a ton of hard currency. With that money, they can buy the things they'd like to have, and buy the tools to build the things they can make on their own. This will reindustrialize their country, Jack. Jumpstart them into the new century. Assuming they have the brains to make proper use of it and not let it all bug out to Switzerland and Liechtenstein.
How can we help them? POTUS asked.
Best answer to that, you and I and 2 or 3 others sit down with our Russian counterparts and ask them what they need. If we can get a few of our industrialists to build some plants over there, it won't hurt, and it'll damn sure look good on TV.
Noted, George. Get me a paper on that by the beginning of next week, and then we'll see if we can figure out a way to let the Russians know what we know.
It was the end of another overlong day for Sergei Golovko. Running the SVR was job enough for any man. But he also had to back up Eduard Petrovich Grushevoy, President of the Russian Republic. President Grushevoy had his own collection of ministers, some of them competent, the others selected for their political capital, or merely to deny them to the political opposition. They could still do damage on the inside of Grushevoy's administration, but less than on the outside. On the inside, they had to use small-caliber weapons, lest they be killed by their own shots. The good news was that the economics minister, Vasily Konstantinovich Solomentsev, was intelligent and seemingly honest as well, as rare a combination in the Russian political spectrum as anywhere else in the known world. He had his ambitions. It was a rare minister who did not. But mainly it seemed he wanted his nation to prosper, and didn't want to profit himself all that much. A little self-enrichment was all right with Golovko, just so that a man wasn't a pig about it. The line for Sergei Nikolaevich was about 20 million euros. More than that was hoggish, but less was understandable. After all, if a minister was successful at helping his country, he or she was entitled to get a proper reward for doing so. The ordinary working people out there wouldn't mind. If the result was a better life for them, would they? Probably not, the spymaster thought. This wasn't America, overrun with pointless and counterproductive ethics laws. The American president, whom Golovko knew well, had an aphorism that the Russian admired. If you have to write your ethics rules down, you've already lost. No fool, that Ryan, once a deadly enemy, and now a good friend, or seemingly so. Golovko had cultivated that friendship by providing help to America in 2 serious international crises. He'd done it because it had, first of all, been in his nation's interest, and secondly, because Ryan was a man of honor, and unlikely to forget such favors. It had also amused Golovko, who'd spent most of his adulthood in an agency devoted to the destruction of the West.
But what about himself? Was someone intent on his own destruction?
Had someone desired to end his life in a loud and spectacular manner on the paving stones of Dzerzhinsky Square? The more his mind dwelt on that question, the more frightening it became. Few healthy men could contemplate the end of their lives with equanimity, and Golovko wasn't one of them. His hands never shook, but he didn't argue at all with Major Shalepin's increasingly invasive measures to keep him alive. The car changed every day in color, and sometimes in make, and the routes to his office shared only the starting place. The SVR building was sufficiently large that the daily journey to work had a total of 5 possible endpoints. The clever part, which Golovko admired, was that he himself occasionally rode in the front seat of the lead vehicle, while some functionary sat in the back seat of the putative guarded car.
Anatoly was no fool, and even showed the occasional spark of creativity. But none of that now. Golovko shook his head and opened his last folder of the day, scanning first of all the executive summary. And his mind skidded to an almost instant halt, his hand reaching for a phone and dialing a number. "This is Golovko," he told the male voice who answered. He didn't have to say anything else. "Sergei Nikolaevich," the minister's voice greeted him pleasantly 5 seconds later. "What can I do for you?"
"Well, Vasily Konstantinovich, you can confirm these numbers to me. Are they possible?"
"They are more than possible, Sergei. They are as real as the sunset," Solomentsev told the intelligence chief, come chief minister and advisor to President Grushevoy.
"Solkin's in," the intelligence chief muttered. "Son of a bitch."
"And this wealth has been there for how long?" he asked incredulously. "The oil, perhaps 500,000 years. The gold, rather longer, Sergei."
"And we never knew," Golovko breathed.
"No one really looked, comrade minister."
"Actually, I find the gold report the more interesting. I must see one of these gold-encrusted wolf pelts."
"Something for Prokofiev, eh? Peter and the Golden Wolf."
"An entertaining thought," Golovko said, dismissing it immediately.
"What will it mean to our country?"
"Sergei Nikolaevich, I would have to be a fortune-teller to answer that substantively. But it could be the salvation of our country in the long term. Now we have something that all nations want. Two somethings, as a matter of fact. And it belongs to us. And for it those foreigners will pay vast sums of money. And do so with a smile. Japan, for example. We will answer their energy needs for the next 50 years. And along the way we will save them vast sums in transportation costs. Ship the oil a few hundred kilometers instead of 10,000. And perhaps America, too, though they've made their own big strike on the Alaskan-Canadian border. The question becomes how we move the oil to market. We'll build a pipeline from the field to Vladivostok, of course, but maybe another one to St. Petersburg so that we can sell oil more easily to Europe as well. In fact, we can probably have the Europeans, especially the Germans, build the pipeline for us, just to get a discount on the oil. Sergei, if we'd found this oil 20 years ago, we...
Perhaps."
It wasn't hard to imagine what would come next. The Soviet Union would not have fallen, but grown strong instead. Golovko had no such illusions. The Soviet government would have managed to fuck up these new treasures, as it had fucked up everything else. The Soviet government had owned Siberia for 70 years, but had never even gone looking for what might have been there. The country had lacked the proper experts to do the looking, but was too proud to let anyone else do it, lest they think less of the motherland. If any one thing had killed the USSR, it wasn't communism, or even totalitarianism. It was that perverse amour propre that was the most dangerous and destructive aspect of the Russian character, created by a sense of inferiority that went back to the House of Romanov and beyond. The Soviet Union's death had been as self-inflicted as any suicide's, just slower and therefore far deadlier in coming. Golovko endured the next 90 seconds of historical speculation from a man who had little sense of history, then spoke.
"All this is good, Vasily Konstantinovich, but what of the future? That is the time in which we will all live, after all."
"It will do us little harm. Sergei, this is the salvation of our country. It will take 10 years to get the full benefit from the oil fields, but then we shall have a steady and regular income for at least one whole generation, and perhaps more besides."
"What help will we need?"
"The Americans and the British have expertise which we need, from their own exploitation of the Alaskan fields. They have knowledge. We shall learn it and make use of it. We are in negotiations now with Atlantic Richfield, the American oil company, for technical support. They are being greedy, but that's to be expected. They know that only they have what we need, and paying them for it is cheaper than having to replicate it ourselves. So they will get most of what they now demand. Perhaps we will pay them in gold bricks, Solomentsev suggested lightly. Golovko had to resist the temptation to inquire too deeply into the gold strike. The oil field was far more lucrative, but gold was prettier. He, too, wanted to see one of those pelts that this Gogol fellow had used to collect the dust. And this lonely forest dweller would have to be properly taken care of. No major problem, as he lived alone and was childless. Whatever he got, the state would soon get back, old as he was. And there'd be a TV show, maybe even a feature film, about this hunter. He'd once hunted Germans, after all, and the Russians still made heroes of such men. That would make Pavel Petrovich Gogol happy enough, wouldn't it? What does Eduard Petrovich know? I've been saving the information until I had a full and reliable reading on it. I have that now. I think he will be pleased at the next cabinet meeting, Sergei Nikolaevich. As well he should, Golovko thought. President Grushevoy had been as busy as a one-armed, one-legged paper hanger for 3 years. No, more like a stage magician or conjurer, forced to produce real things from nothing. And his success in keeping the nation moving often seemed nothing short of miraculous. Perhaps this was God's own way of rewarding the man for his efforts, though it would not be an entirely unmixed blessing. Every government agency would want its piece of the gold and oil pie, each with its needs, all of them presented by its own minister as vital to the security of the state, in white papers of brilliant logic and compelling reasoning. Who knew? Maybe some of them could even be telling the truth, though truth was so often a rare commodity in the cabinet room. Each minister had an empire to build, and the better he built it, the closer he would come to the seat at the head of the table that was occupied, for now, by Eduard Petrovich Grushevoy. Golovko wondered if it had been this way under the Tsars. Probably, he decided at once. Human nature didn't change very much. The way people had acted in Babylon or Byzantium was probably little different from the way they'd act at the next cabinet meeting, 3 days hence. He wondered how President Grushevoy would handle the news. "How much has leaked out?" the spymaster asked. "There are doubtless some rumors," Minister Solomentsev answered, "but the current estimates are less than 24 hours old, and it usually takes longer than that to leak. I will have these documents messengered to you. Tomorrow morning?" "That will be fine, Vasily. I'll have some of my own analysts go over the data so that I can present my own independent estimate of the situation." "I have no objection to that," the economics minister responded, surprising Golovko more than a little. But then this wasn't the USSR anymore. The current cabinet might be the modern counterpart to the old Politburo, but nobody there told lies. Well, at least, not big lies. And that was a measure of progress for his country, wasn't it? Chapter 11 Faith of the Fathers. His name was Yufa An, and he said he was a Christian. That was rare enough that Monsignor Shepka invited him in at once. What he saw was a Chinese national of 50-plus years and stooped frame, with hair a curious mix of black and gray that one saw only rarely in this part of the world. "Welcome to our embassy. I am Monsignor Shepka." He bowed quickly and then shook the man's hand. "Thank you. I am the Reverend Yufa An," the man replied with the dignity of truth, one cleric to another.
"Indeed. Of what denomination?"
"I am a Baptist."
"Ordained? Is that possible?"
Shepka motioned the visitor to follow him, and in a moment they stood before the nuncio.
"Eminence, this is the Reverend Yu Fa'an."
"Of Beijing?" Shepka asked belatedly.
"Yes, that is so. My congregation is mainly northwest of here."
"Welcome." Cardinal DeMilo rose from his chair for a warm handshake and guided the man to the comfortable visitor's chair. Monsignor Shepka went to fetch tea. "It is a pleasure to meet a fellow Christian in this city."
"There are not enough of us, and that is a fact, Eminence," you confirmed.
Monsignor Shepka swiftly arrived with a tray of tea things, which he set on the low coffee table.
"Thank you, Franz.
I thought that some local citizens should welcome you. I expect you've had the formal welcome from the Foreign Ministry, and that it was correct."
"And rather cold?" you asked. The Cardinal smiled as he handed a cup to his guest.
"It was correct, as you say, but it could have been warmer."
"You will find that the government here has ample manners and good attention to protocol, but little in the way of sincerity," you said, in English, with a very strange accent.
"You are originally from—"
"I was born in Taipei. As a youth, I traveled to America for my education. I first attended the University of Oklahoma, but the call came and I transferred to Oral Roberts University in the same state. There, I got my first degree, in electrical engineering, and went on for my Doctor of Divinity and my ordination," he explained.
"Indeed, and how did you come to be in the People's Republic?"
"Back in the 1970s, the government of Chairman Mao was ever so pleased to have Taiwanese come here to live. Rejecting capitalism and coming to Marxism, you see," he added with a twinkling eye. "It was hard on my parents, but they came to understand. I started my congregation soon after I arrived. That was troublesome for the Ministry of State Security. But I also worked as an engineer, and at the time the state needed that particular skill. It is remarkable what the state will accept if you have something it needs. And back then their need for people with my degree was quite desperate. But now I am a minister on a full-time basis." With the announcement of his triumph, Yu lifted his own teacup for a sip.
"So, what can you tell us about the local environment?" Renato asked.
"The government is truly communist. It trusts and tolerates no loyalty to anything except itself. Even the Falun Gong, which was not truly a religion, that is, not really a belief system as you or I would understand the term, has been brutally suppressed, and my own congregation has been persecuted. It is a rare Sunday on which more than a quarter of my congregation comes to attend services. I must spend much of my time traveling from home to home to bring the gospel to my flock."
"How do you support yourself?" the Cardinal asked.
Yu smiled serenely.
"That is the least of my problems.
American Baptists support me most generously. There is a group of churches in Mississippi that is particularly generous. Many are black churches, as it turns out. I just received some letters from them yesterday,